and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I've got a couple of students from the Translational Medicine Program. We have Sophia Skibo and Isaac Emon, who are both doing a Master of Science under the supervision of Drs. Stephen Archer and Mark Ormiston. Welcome to Grad Chat, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. So you've both gone from undergrad at Queen's to now pursuing this Master's in Translational Medicine. What made you want to do that and in Translational Medicine? Because I know, Isaac, you're from Life Sciences, and Sophia, you're from Biology.
For sure. So yeah, I did a life sciences undergrad degree here at Queen's, and I specialized in cancer research in my fourth year.
Okay. You did that research project.
Yeah, so I did a fourth year research project. I never really truly understood what research was like behind the scenes, but I wanted to try it out in my fourth year and was able to do a thesis project and really enjoyed it. I'd always been pretty interested in the clinical side of things as well, and healthcare, working with patients, and so translational medicine really appealed to me because it kind of balances both the research side of things and the clinical side of things.
Right.
So we do translational research, which is essentially research that's applicable to a clinical setting, whether that's more basic science research or clinical research, and it kind of also allows us to have some clinical opportunities in the Department of Medicine where we can observe physicians and work alongside them in like learning sessions and learning opportunities.
Right, right.
So yeah, it kind of balances that nicely, which I really appreciated, so I could continue with the research side of things, also a little bit more in a clinical
right.
setting.
So it's a bit of both, which is nice for you.
Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah. And it's pretty unique. A lot of programs are one or the other, or most research masters, you don't get those clinical opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of one of its kind.
Okay.
So yeah, it was quite...
Well, that was a nice long answer. Thank you very much for that. No, no, it was all good. And what about you, Sophia? What made you come from biology to translational medicine?
Yeah, so kind of like a little bit more of a, I guess, a different path. So... I guess, way back when I was starting my undergrad, I was interested in a bunch of different things. So I just decided to go into bio. I liked the kind of all the different aspects you got, because you get everything from ecology to evolutionary biology to more of the cell and molecular. And I wasn't really sure what I liked. And then kind of in, third and fourth year, I realized I really liked that kind of cellular molecular biology component. And more so how it applied to disease, like kind of pathology and that kind of stuff. So I did like a fourth year thesis project in Mark's lab. And then I kind of carried that through and decided to do a master's with it, because I just think research is kind of fun. It's kind of, trying at times, but it's cool when you can kind of problem solve and figure out what next steps to pursue. Specifically, why did I choose like translational medicine? For similar reasons, I thought it was kind of more of whatever I'm doing in the lab will somehow have outcomes in the clinic. It's kind of this bench to bedside, approach that people talk about. And I thought that there's more purpose to kind of what I'm doing and the research I'm doing if I know it's going to eventually, hopefully, benefit patients in some way. And then again, kind of the same way, I feel, because you get a lot of the clinical kind of experience from shadowing doctors and things like that, and seeing how clinician scientists run their labs and everything, you can make connections, but you can also see what those types of jobs are like, because I'm someone who doesn't necessarily know what I'd like to do yet. So I feel like that exposure is very cool as well.
You do know we have an MD PhD program, so you can do both the medicine, the clinical, as well as the research.
Exactly.
Now it's a long program, of course, but it is there, and people do complete it.
Yes. Yeah, I do know some people in that, and it's intense, but I think it's super rewarding too, because again, whatever you're studying in med school, you can actually see those diseases, and you're studying those in kind of real time in whatever lab work you're doing. So. yeah, that was my path, I guess.
I've always liked those programs that you can see the practical application of what you're studying.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, now, why are we doing this? You, whatever you determine from your research, you want it to be used. Otherwise, it's just sitting on a shelf and that, you know, that was nice. We found that out.
Yeah. No, exactly.
So that's really good that you're doing that. But a master's is very short.
Yeah.
It's not very long to be doing this kind of work, particularly in sort of the health setting, because we know how finicky some of those research projects are and can take years and years and years.
Yeah. No, I would say, like, definitely timelines, especially when you, I don't know, I was like this at least, like, when you get into research, you think, oh, you know, my timeline, like, I'm going to plan to do cell work for this long or whatever other models for this long, and then it always takes way longer than you expect it to, whether it's because it doesn't work or whether it's just you building up the skills and everything like that. So, you know, once you're in a master's, you know, some people might think, oh, another 2 years of school, like, that's so long. But it's really not.
Right. It goes fast.
It goes quite fast, especially for, like, the volume of work you're doing and everything like that. But it's still, you know, valuable experience to kind of fit into 2 years. But I know a lot of people sometimes think, oh, I'll, you know, do some more research and then upgrade to a PhD. So
I think the hard part is the writing, because the fun part is the doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, you still have to write it down.
I know. Yeah.
So, are you looking forward to that?
Yeah. So I'm kind of going through that process now. So I'm in my second year, my master's. Sophia's in her first. And so I'm slowly getting into the thesis writing side of things. I mean, I'm fortunate in the sense that TMed makes you write a review article, like a literature review.
Right, yes.
In the field at the start of your master's.
Great.
And so it kind of provides that background, like, basis for the thesis, which is nice because it takes a bit of the load off now, even though it's a lot of work at the start. But looking back, I'm very grateful that I have that. But yeah, the writing, you know, I find writing, like, literature review writing and searching through what's already out there often to be tougher, because when you're writing about your own research, you know what you did.
Exactly right.
And so, you know, whether, you know, methodology, results, you know, it's either you did it or you didn't. And so you write that down, you can discuss it at the end. But, you know, it's really gaining that background knowledge, understanding what's already been done, and trying to compile that into, like, an introduction and to set the foundation for the reader as to, you know, why this is important.
Have you been building on someone else's? Because, I mean, there's a lot of work has already been done in certain fields. And that's that helps you go, okay, well, I'm not going to try that because that clearly didn't work, which is really, really helpful so you don't go down that track. But often you have to build on from what other people have done.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's often, you know, the first step in research is kind of identifying, like, where the gap is,
where the gap is, right.
And, you know, being aware of what has been done, like you said, like, what's worked and what hasn't and what may have potential to work. And if... And, you know, a lot of the time, like, big discoveries, like, they're just ideas at the start, you know what I mean? And, you know, this, you try something out, it may or may not work, you're more likely to fail a ton of times before you actually...
Which can be a bit despondent.
Yeah, there's a lot of setbacks.
A bit depressing at times, but...
For sure.
But they still give you answers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, like, totally true. You know, if you try something and it doesn't work, you know you don't try it again. And you're still, you're still learning from that. But yeah, I'd say... You know, familiar, I can get a bit more into, like, what I do in a bit. But, yeah, working off of previous discoveries and, you know, knowledge that we already have and trying to put pieces together to see how, you know, there might be avenues for therapeutics that are targeted in certain diseases and maybe not the disease we're looking in.
Right.
Or, you know, there's a lot of overlaps between a lot of
Different models and things that, you know, well, let me try that part of that model because that might work in this particular situation.
Yeah, so having, that kind of that background and working from there is, like, definitely helpful. Yeah.
So let's talk about your work then, because you're both doing totally different projects, but in a similar area, and it's in pulmonary hypertension. So first of all, what is pulmonary hypertension? And then, you know, what are each of you looking at in that? Because I know they're different, but ultimately, both your angles will hopefully help what this situation is.
Yeah, for sure. So pulmonary hypertension. Most people are familiar with hypertension, but you may not be. So hypertension is essentially the medical or clinical term for high blood pressure.
Okay.
And so tons of people have high blood pressure, mm-hmm. known as hypertension, specifically systemic hypertension. So the way that our, you know, circulation kind of works, like our blood circulation, is our heart pumps blood to the rest of our body, yep. delivers oxygen, and then it comes back to the heart. And then it goes to the lungs to pick up more oxygen, comes back to the heart, and is pumped back throughout the body. And so that circulation that's going from the heart to the lungs and back to the heart mm-hmm. is called the pulmonary circulation. Okay. Pulmonary is yep. essentially a term for the lungs. And so you have that pulmonary circulation and then the systemic circulation, which would be the rest throughout the your rest. Body. Mm-hmm. So most people, when they say, well, I have high blood pressure or hypertension, they're referring to the systemic circulation throughout their body. Now, we are
looking... And that could be from things like thickening of the arteries and yeah. because it's harder to get...
100%.
Hard to get the blood through.
Yeah. I was going to say super multifactorial.
Right, yes.
Of, you know, that, mm-hmm. that regard.
Absolutely. So we're looking at specifically at hypertension in the pulmonary circulation. So pulmonary hypertension, essentially high blood pressure in the lungs. And there's five groups of pulmonary hypertension.
Oh, okay.
So group 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We're, Sophia and I are both specifically looking at group 1 okay. pulmonary hypertension, which is also known as pulmonary arterial hypertension.
Okay, so it's to do with the arteries?
It has to do with the arteries.
The arteries going from the heart to the lungs?
100%, exactly. Okay. So if you think of it, like you have the arteries going from the heart to the lungs, which don't have oxygen in mm-hmm. them because they're going to go to the lungs to pick up that oxygen. And then it goes through the capillary bed in the lungs to get the oxygen and then is returned by veins to the heart.
Right.
And so when you have that pre-capillary hypertension, so that high blood pressure in the arteries before it gets to the lungs, as you had said, that's what we call pulmonary arterial hypertension.
Okay.
And the risk is that it kind of creates like an increased resistance on the heart. And so the heart has to pump more because there's that congestion, essentially, right?
Right.
And eventually it causes the heart to, like the right ventricle of the heart, which is pumping the blood to the lungs, to become hypertrophic, which essentially means it thickens and it becomes fibrotic.
Okay, so it's too muscular.
Exactly.
Point.
It's too muscular. It starts to stiffen.
Right.
And the actual wall gets bigger and eventually it just can't quite contract the way it's supposed to.
Right.
And the heart will fail.
So it's still a problem in the heart.
Mm-hmm. So it's primarily the problem in the heart yeah. because that is what
it's not able to provide the blood to the
correct.
To the lungs.
Yeah. So you have high blood pressure in the lungs, but it causes heart failure. And that is right. what is fatal for patients.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would be. Yeah. So that's interesting too, because that distance is not very long compared to the rest of the circulatory system,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So it's got less capacity to fail.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're both looking at that part, the pulmonary arterial
hypertension.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So what makes what you're each doing different? Because Isaac, you're looking at the inflammation as a major contributor mm-hmm. to the disease.
Yeah.
And Sophia, your angle is looking at the abnormal vascular growth mm-hmm. leading to heart failure.
Yes.
So explain both of that, both of you.
Let me start. Okay.
Each of you.
So kind of one other aspect of, or like a characteristic of, like for short form, we'll just call pulmonary arterial hypertension PH, because it is kind of a mouthful even for me, even though I'm studying it. So kind of one aspect of that is abnormal vascular growth. And when you basically get vascular growth, so this would be like the capillaries or the blood vessels in the lungs, if you end up getting... so
okay.
the blood vessels will that are in the lungs will be kind of disorganized. So they will not be able... That's kind of part of the reason why we end up getting kind of higher blood pressure and more resistance going through the lungs. But within your blood vessels, you have something called endothelial cells. And those are the cells that line the very inner layer of your blood vessel.
Okay.
In the context of this disease, because there's kind of a genetic basis to it, you can end up getting these endothelial cells to proliferate and grow like abnormally. And this can actually cause the inner layer of your blood vessels to shrink. And if you have like a kind of smaller area for blood to go through, that's
it's
part of what
again.
Creates the resistance and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
But But this is genetic, you're saying.
Yeah, there's a genetic component to it. Exactly.
I hate that when we have to blame genetics. Yeah, I know. Think, what can we do to fix that? It's our genetics. We can't do anything. Exactly. Or can we?
Yeah.
Or can we?
Yeah. And so that's kind of one of the, you know, driving points for, you know, both of our research, because there is a genetic component. And so the whole idea is, if you can access and understand better the genetic basis of the disease, again, from various angles, then you can better tackle the disease and you know, help patients that have it. So for my project, I'm interested in understanding why we get this abnormal blood vessel growth in the lungs. And so to better understand this, I want to understand the protein signaling within endothelial cells, because if those are part of the, you know, problem, although there are, you know, other cells that end up proliferating and stuff like that too, then, you know, we can better understand how to prevent this from happening.
So this, we can't classify this as a cancer thing. It's just a mutation of sorts or an imbalance of the chemicals.
Yeah. Honestly, some people do kind of characterize the abnormal growth of endothelial cells as kind of this cancer-like proliferation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, similarly in tumors and things like that within cancer, you also do get abnormal blood vessel growth as well. So, and, you know, some of the same mechanisms may be at play depending on the individual's genetics and whatnot. But yeah, so I'm interested in looking at the endothelial cells. And so they have these proteins on them, kind of that are, you know, sticking out of the endothelial cells, right, you know, into the blood. And this protein is called bone morphogenetic protein receptor type 2.
Love that name.
Love that name. It's so easy to remember.
It just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Exactly. We're going to short form that, and we're just going to call it BMPR2.
Lovely.
But basically, it's this protein receptor, and there are these other, you know, proteins that kind of float throughout the blood, which we call ligands, because they will bind to this yes. receptor. This protein, similar name, it's called BMP9. And so I'm interested in what happens when BMP9 is binding to BMPR2 on the surface of these endothelial cells.
Okay.
Because it's shown that in patients with the disease, some of them will lack this protein receptor. And we think that this is, you know, implicated in how these endothelial cells will grow and proliferate abnormally.
That's not going to be easy to find, is it? Because, I mean, it's clearly hit and miss. Some do and some don't.
Exactly.
It's not like everyone is either have it, has it, or doesn't have it.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's kind of the kind of difficulty with the disease, because, you know, normally if you have, you know, genetically all of the receptor or kind of half of the receptor, it will produce a certain effect. But in the case of PAH, we don't always see the disease severity correlated with the amount of receptor. So that's kind of showing that it's multifaceted. There's other, you know,
other things in play.
Exactly. Other kind of environmental factors and things
like
that.
So you're just trying to take away one little piece.
Exactly.
But there could be other variables there that actually have a more important implications to the whole process. So your thing might be perfectly fine.
Yeah.
That's annoying.
I know. Because some individuals who have the mutation, you know, like you or I, we might not present any disease symptoms.
Right.
But then some individuals who do have these mutations and, you know, symptoms can be more severe when you do have the mutation and whatnot. So in order to kind of, you know, elucidate or figure out how these proteins signal, because if we better understand the signaling pathway of this protein, then we can better understand.
Because it could be an interruption in the signal somewhere.
Exactly. And kind of, you know, downstream factors and like everything like that. So my project in this area is kind of centered on creating this reporter to view signaling kinetics. So what does that mean? If you have the BMPR2 protein, so on the surface of endothelial cells, when you get that ligand, that BMP9 binding to it, it creates this huge cascade within the cell. So what does that mean? It means that a bunch of proteins activate other proteins, which activate other ones.
Okay, so it goes down the line.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what I want to do is I want to look at one of those downstream proteins that are, you know, within the cell, and I'm going to see how it moves within a cell and use that as a measure of essentially signaling kinetics. So seeing how the signaling pathway is affected when we don't have the receptor.
Okay, right.
To do this.
You can look at one that's working properly and one that's not.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so I can look at this in healthy cells and then cells that don't have this receptor. And so how I'm doing this is I'm taking one of those downstream proteins and I'm actually putting on a fluorescent protein. So it's called
GFP. So you can watch it.
So I can actually see these cells that...
Oh, that's pretty cool.
They glow green. Yeah, I know. Cool. Yeah. So basically, I'm adding on... It's called GFP or green fluorescent protein. And I'm just adding that on to a portion of one of these proteins. And so when this kind of signaling cascade is activated by this initial receptor on the surface of cells, I can see how the green changes within the cell and use that as a readout of what's going on.
Wow. Well, that is a huge job.
Yes.
So you're looking at one end of it. Yes. But then, Isaac, I take it you're looking at the different end.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, the thing with not only our research, but most research, you know, there's so many different parts. And as Sophia mentioned, you know, there's, like, she's working on endothelial cells. The next layer in the blood cells are smooth muscle cells.
Okay,
which our lab is fairly focused on. And as, you know, was kind of touched on, it's very, pulmonary hypertension, specifically pulmonary arterial hypertension, PAH, is very similar to cancer, as you kind of asked about. It's a hyperproliferative disease, which essentially means too much proliferation or too much cell growth.
Right.
So like in cancer, cells are growing uncontrollably.
Yeah.
Similar to what Sophia is describing here. In the arteries, we have this uncontrolled growth of endothelial cells and smooth muscle cells, which is, you know, preventing that blood flow through the circulation. Now, my work specifically is looking at the role of inflammation, and there's been a lot of emerging evidence in the last 10 or so years that suggests inflammation and inflammatory cells. So these are our immune cells.
Mm-hmm. These ones are meant to help us.
Yeah. So yeah.
fight the baddies.
Yeah. Exactly. So generally, inflammation is, you know, it's often a good thing because it's fighting disease and infection, etc. But sometimes inflammation can also be have a negative role. You know, it can also
work too well.
Yes. Exactly. And we see that, you know, sometimes in autoimmune diseases, you know, our immune system is very complex. And like in autoimmune diseases, for example, our body's essentially fighting against itself. And so in pulmonary hypertension, we know that inflammation plays a role also both in the lungs. So in this, what's termed vascular remodeling, essentially the proliferation of those cells, the shrinking of the blood vessels. But also in the heart, in the failing heart, when that, you know, fibrosis is developing, and what I talked about with the overload on the heart, as it starts to contract weaker, we know that there's a role of inflammation in there as well.
And so that role is meant to be what?
So
make them more pliable, again?
Essentially, there's immune cells that specifically, you know, there's been research done on macrophages, which are a type of immune cell.
Yes.
And they basically promote this inflammatory pathway that recruits inflammation and more inflammatory cells to the heart.
Right.
And so we know that that plays a role in the fibrosis. Now, what we are looking at specifically is this mutation that happens in blood cells. And so you, at the very start, asked me about CHIP.
Yes.
So that stands for clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential. Yeah, so clonal, essentially, like, you know, to clone something, there's, you know, more of it or et cetera. And hematopoiesis is the replication of our blood cells. So in all of our bodies, our blood cells, they're termed hematopoietic stem cells. They're in our bone marrow. That's what becomes our blood.
Yes.
And so all, like, the blood all throughout our body is coming from our bone marrow. And so in the bone marrow, these cells are replicating. And so that development of these cells is called hematopoiesis.
Okay.
The development of blood cells. And so we have clonal hematopoiesis. So we have this cloning of cells, of blood cells in our bone marrow, but at an uncontrolled rate. Sometimes.
Okay.
So not everyone has this.
Right.
Now, it's termed CHIP, okay? And it's a complicated idea, but to put it in perspective, about 1 in 10 people, so about 10% of people by the age of 65 have what we call CHIP.
Okay.
Okay. And so essentially, it's primarily due to aging, the aging population. You know, we have these mutations in blood cells that sometimes allow those cells to proliferate
Too much.
Like cancer. Yeah, too much. And so now we're developing this subset, which we call a clone.
Right.
That's kind of affecting the ability for those blood cells to function normally. And it kind of shifts them towards inflammatory cells.
Okay.
Towards more inflammation.
Right, right.
So,
because you'd think actually having more red blood cells would be a good thing.
Yeah, so red blood cells, often yes.
Or white blood cells,
white
then?
Blood cells are the ones that become our immune cells.
Okay, yes.
And
okay.
So those ones, we often, in the case of CHIP, mm-hmm. they're shifted towards an increase in inflammation. Kind
so
of
too
a,
much white.
Exactly. Yeah, too much white, and the type of white is yeah. is more inflammatory.
So all the ratios are out of whack.
The ratio, exactly.
Right.
So the ratios, because of this CHIP, the ratios in your blood cells are off, essentially.
Right,
you
right.
have too much inflammation. And CHIP is a precursor to leukemia, to acute myeloid leukemia.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. right? So it is cancer-related. And so that's where it's most well studied. But recently, in the last, like I said, 10 or so years, a lot of different studies have looked at CHIP in diseases way beyond cancer.
Right, which is why it comes to the
which
pulmonary
is where it comes
arterial.
To pulmonary hypertension. And because we know that pulmonary arterial hypertension has an inflammatory component,
right,
we're
okay.
looking at how these CHIP mutations in mm-hmm. in our blood cells actually may promote that disease.
And assuming they've gone that far.
Correct. Yeah, so they've as soon as they're in the bloodstream, they travel throughout,
they're gonna get,
throughout the body.
They're going to get right? there eventually anyway.
Yeah. yeah, and so we're looking at basically both in humans and in mouse models how these mutations can promote this disease.
Right.
Specifically via an increase in inflammation. So we look at inflammation in the lungs. Yeah.
But you said a lot of this is kind of happening as you're getting older. Are you bringing in that variable, the age factor, or is it just looking at the...
Yeah, so... Our patients that we're looking at, on average, I mean, PAH is primarily diagnosed in middle-aged women.
Okay, so that was one of the questions I wanted to ask. I mean, who
yeah.
are the most
yeah.
affected by this mm-hmm. disease?
Yeah. yeah, primarily women in their 40s, 50s, even 60s. So middle-aged women. but something to keep in mind, PAH is very rare.
Oh, it is rare? Okay,
yeah,
but that makes
very,
me feel better.
Yeah. Pulmonary hypertension as a whole isn't quite as rare.
Right.
But group one, pulmonary arterial hypertension, what we're studying, is
right.
is quite rare, but it's quite fatal, which is why there's so much research in that field.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah, you don't want to get group one.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the patients that we look at are middle-aged to later-aged patients. And we're essentially looking at...
Thank you for not asking me to be a volunteer.
Well, so we use a large biobank of patients.
That's good.
With PAH there from around
it.
The
okay.
United States.
Right.
Actually, and yeah, so we compare, you know, this CHIP, essentially, in patients with the disease and patients without.
Without.
And we look to see if there's, you know,
see
some kind of association.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do take into account the age aspect. But one thing, you know, I said 10% of people by the age of 65 have CHIP, and that's actually up to about 30% by the age of 85.
Oh.
So there is an increasing incidence with age of CHIP. But something that's, you know, more positive to keep in mind is that most of the time it won't manifest as a disease. In fact,
okay.
less than 1% of the time does CHIP actually lead to a cancer, like leukemia.
Why? Sorry, I hate to say this, but why can't the blokes get it?
The
I
who?
Mean, the bloke, the men.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Well, hey, there are, you know, yeah.
No, I was going to say, in the case of PAH specifically, I was going to, you know, say this before to make you feel, you know, better. Even though it is more common in women, when men do get PAH, it is
it's
worse.
It's worse?
Yeah.
So,
okay, well, that's,
yeah.
that
there
balances
is a little bit of
out then.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah,
higher mortality
yeah.
rate
right.
in men.
Yeah.
Right. It's almost like almost a 4-to-1 ratio, female to male, as far as incidence,
oh, wow.
getting
yes,
the disease.
Right.
But basically reversed
right.
for mortality.
Oh, that's not good.
For disease
I
severity.
Wouldn't wish that on anyone.
So.
Even all you blokes.
Yeah.
but yeah, so that's a bit of an idea of what I'm working
yeah.
on. So kind of like these blood-related disorders and mm-hmm. mutations that change our inflammatory profile in our bodies.
Right.
Increase immune cells and how that causes this disease.
So between the two of you, I mean, you really are coming from different, right? One's a signaling type mm-hmm. thing and one's of, you know, an overreactive immune
inflammation,
inflammation sort of system that's going on. But but I guess putting them all together, and that's only looking at one type, putting them all together, it's looking a bit dire, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's...
When you break, sometimes when you break it down, you think, oh, why did we break it down that much? Because it means more of this, this, and this.
Yeah.
But clearly we need to break it down that much to really figure it out.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, research is getting, it gets more and more specific.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
because when does diet and things come in? I mean, exactly. Most people think of anything like this, it's diet or the way you're living and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas this could be purely genetic and something just switch, certain time it switches on or off, whichever it may be, whichever way the trigger is meant to be. And another one could be, who knows?
Yeah, sometimes it's unknown. In fact, almost half of, well, 40% at least of cases of PAH are idiopathic, which essentially means they have no known cause.
Well, that makes it difficult to treat.
Exactly.
Yeah. And another, a huge proportion are also associated with autoimmune disease and connective tissue diseases.
Right, right.
And so there are some risk factors for sure, but as Sophia mentioned, you know, genetics definitely play a role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm looking at specific genes that cause this CHIP. So
Down the track, we could get a little genetic test to see whether we're actually potential to get it.
And there, that happens. There are, like, patients do get screened.
I think
screened
I'd rather not know. But.
Yeah, patients do get screened for mutation.
But unless you know how to fix it, there's no point getting the test, really, is it?
Yeah, it's helpful for early detection and, like, screening so that you can try to implement therapeutics earlier. And you're more aware if you have a mutation that you may develop.
Right.
Yeah. So you can be on treatment.
So if you're suddenly feeling shortness of breath, and there could be other factors to it.
Yeah, yes. Shortness of breath, like, is the like most common symptom.
Well, so I really do appreciate you both coming on and talking about different aspects of this one disease, because I think it's important for us all to realize nothing is as simple as it. It's just, this is one thing, and this is what causes this, and this is how you treat it. There's so much more that has to go into it to figure things out, whether we can actually prevent it beforehand,
exactly.
Or what are the best treatment methods if we can't do that.
Yeah.
But first of all, you've got to figure out what actually caused it in the first place. So thank you very much for giving us an idea on that. I'm sure people have learned heaps, because I know I have. So if you want to come on again, please do. I'm sure we could talk a lot longer. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Glad. It's been been a pleasure. Yeah, hopefully people understood
parts
of what we were, of what we were talking about.
Yeah. No, I think you explained it, both of you, very, very well. So thank you for that. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcasts. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.